contributions to federal insurance, federal and state insurance programs, Social Security, workers' compensation, and unemployment insurance. Those percentages, those are imposed as a percentage of salaries, and those percentages have been largely unchanged for decades. And so the true cost drivers on the benefits side have been the retirement system and health insurance premiums.
And Mr. Reeder, just a question. The workforce in K through 12, demographically, is it accurate to say that it skews a little bit more experienced people? So in other words, there's a larger percentage of people that are at the higher end of the salary as we look today. Is that accurate?
Chair Galizio, one of the things that I track fairly closely when I try to forecast compensation is the age structure of Oregon's teachers in particular. And what we have observed is that up until about 2 or 3 years ago, there was a bubble of teachers in the mid-50s to late-50s age range that were very close to retirement age. And so the answer to your question in general is yes. We see this relatively older population among our teachers, and that bubble, what we saw was, as that bubble was at its largest point, we also found ourselves in a situation where getting out of public service because of the PERS system looked very attractive. So both the age structure and the retirement system situation led to extremely high level of retirements for 3 or 4 years. We've seen that taper off now, but we still, the age structure of our teaching force is still relatively high, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, additional question on this point. You say in your slide 24% of all districts spend in system employment benefits piece. Can you further break that down between the retirement system versus percentage of the retirement system, and what percentage of the 24 is health insurance? And if you don't have it at the top of your head, if you can get it to us later, it's fine.
Chair Benizio, Senator Starr, I do have that with me. Roughly, of the benefits piece, roughly 29% of that is the retirement system. 51% is benefits, which is predominantly health insurance. And 20% is Social Security, workers' comp, and unemployment insurance.
Thank you. Thank you for that information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Great question.
And then the third real cost driver in the education sector is enrollment growth, and not so much total enrollment growth, but when you break down the student population by certain demographic factors, what we find is certain groups of students, in particular special education students and students for whom English is not their first language, are growing much faster than the general student population is. And to the extent that those students take more resources to educate, that is an important cost driver for schools in Oregon.
Question?
I can see everyone looking for numbers, right?
Yes.
On that,
it'd be really interesting to know what's the general enrollment growth percentage. And then what the percentage increase growth for special education and percentage increase growth for English language learners.
Mm-hmm. Chair Galizio, Senator Starr, we'll get there in about 2 or 3 slides.
Excellent.
Thank you. And I wanted to talk about each of the cost drivers.
Senator Devlin has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Reeder, I just wanted to back up for a moment to the retirement system. Can you give me the data on, because it might be easier for you to get it than it be for me, the school districts, the number of school districts and employees that participated in pension obligation bonds, and the school districts that did not, and the number of employees?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, I certainly can get that. I don't have it with me.
Senator Devlin, I believe our district, that was one of, well, the district that we share did not.
Did not. The only one of my districts that did not.
Tiger 12.
Okay. Wanted to look in a little bit more detail about at each of the three key cost drivers. The first one is employee salaries. And what I have here is a history of salary growth rates in Oregon. The department collects data on salaries of individual teachers, administrators, and so forth. And if you go back to 1991, this slide shows you the average annual growth rates in those salaries by type of position. And I've also provided here for comparison purposes the growth rate in the average wage of all Oregonians over that period, and then the Portland CPI. And what we see here is that, with the exception of teachers, the salaries of all these groups has increased close to a percentage point faster than consumer price inflation has. And that's something that we observe in the economy as a whole, typically. Wages grow faster than inflation, and that's how our standard of living goes up.
Thank you, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this graph is very telling as far as one of the things we, the political arena, keep talking about of putting more dollars in the classroom. The graph or the list that you have here, clearly the dollars are not going in the classroom, the dollars are going into administration. The dollars going into classroom are comparable to the Portland CPI, if I read this correctly. The other three categories all exceed the Portland CPI. And so I suspect the teachers would not like to be looked at as having being a 3.6 percentage, as compared to the Portland CPI, but rather their own. The other thing that I would be really interested in, if the department has it, is the increase in numbers or decrease, as the case may be, for each of these four categories. And it would be interesting also to see it in relationship to the changing numbers as far as students are concerned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're loading up the homework on you, Mr. Reeder. So, sorry. Senator Morse and then Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, to say the least, interesting, more than interesting information with respect to the distribution of increases within these classifications of employees. With respect to the teachers, are we looking at the aggregate totals so that you're not looking at specific classes within seniority time served within, say, the teacher group? Is this the aggregate total of teacher salaries over this time period? If you can understand my question, I'm a little bit alarmed at that number. I would not have suspected that.
Chair Galizio, Senator Morse, these are averages over the entire teaching force in Oregon. So these are based on the actual salaries of teachers.
The aggregate total.
That's correct. Now, one possible explanation for the lower growth rate for teachers is if we were to see a shift to less experienced teachers over this period, because the salary schedules of school districts are based almost exclusively on education and years of experience. It turns out that over this period, the average experience of teachers in Oregon fell by about 0.4 years, so not dramatically. And what I would conclude from that is that this slower growth rate for teacher salaries cannot be entirely attributed to a shift to less experienced teachers. It looks to me like it simply is teacher salaries lagging behind those of other groups.
Okay, Senator Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to note a couple of things that I'm aware of based on my discussion with school superintendents, and also I think obvious from the slide is that every category except superintendents themselves are increases below the average wage increase in Oregon. I think that's something we ought to be worried about. The other thing I'm very aware of is that finding good principals and assistant principals and superintendents now is very difficult for reasons that are not as clear to me, but I know it to be the fact. Every superintendent that I've talked with around my district and in other districts attest to the same thing. A good principal makes the school, and they're hard to find. That their pay may be up slightly more than teachers' pay doesn't surprise me very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Jensen.
Just a brief rebuttal, Mr. Chair. I would say that good teachers make the principal.
Mr. Reeder, turn it over to you. We'll try not to give you too much more homework here. I'm getting away from it.
Okay, look a little bit at trends in employee benefits, and what I've tried to do here is put Oregon in a national context by looking at what share of total compensation has gone to employee benefits over time, and I was unable to find a national number for private workers back in the 1980-81 period. But what I have here is a series of five-year increments that show the progression of larger shares of compensation being paid as benefits in Oregon, and also larger shares nationally. But I think the message here is that they've grown somewhat faster in Oregon than they have nationally. Given that health insurance really is purchased in national markets and those increases are being faced everywhere in the country, both in the private sector and the public sector, what this suggests is that our retirement system is behind these increases that are greater than what the private sector nationally has experienced. And that shouldn't be surprising to any of us, given the what we've experienced in the PERS system in recent years. It's almost inevitable that the share of compensation going to benefits would increase in Oregon faster than it did nationally.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Reeder,
how do we reconcile with those statements the fact that I believe we now have a system where, if you look at what's happened in PERS, obviously even the people under the new retirement system are having to pay what the employer is paying part of the liability, basically. And as we get to a smaller number of Tier 1, and then we have a group of people that are in the Tier 2 category. And then the retirement costs of those people under the new retirement system are not really attributable entirely to them, because what they're in effect doing is paying part of the liability of the system for the people that have already retired and probably the remain, to some extent, the remaining Tier 1 employees. So, I mean, it's when you do comparisons, you say these employees are getting, you know, this rate. They're really not. It's actually we utilize the payroll to pay the cost of the system, and part of that cost is paying the underlying unfunded liability. So,
Trevor Ezio, Senator Devlin, you're exactly right, and I think the reconciliation of this apparent paradox is that we incurred the costs in the past, and now it's time to pay up.
Yeah.
And the costs, the contributions today to pay for the commitments we made in the past come at the expense of today's workers. Those benefits, the benefits of those higher payments don't accrue to today's workers, they accrue to prior workers. And so it's if you look at the timing of the system, what we've done is made commitments in the past that we didn't fully fund in the past, and therefore we're paying for them today.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Senator Devlin, for making me even more resentful. Representative Barnard.
Thank you. And it would be, I think it would be useful to separate those numbers out, if, at least to the extent that can be done. So we can actually we can maybe compare 1980 to 2005 if we look at the payment of current obligations as a separate item from payment for old obligations that we simply didn't fully fund at the time. It may not be possible, but if it is, it would be useful, I think.
Chair Lazio, Representative Barnhart, it's probably possible that PERS could do that. Somebody smarter than I am would have to do that.
Representative Edwards, thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, at the risk of overburdening you with homework, I would actually like to see a chart that's similar to the one on page 11, but this time with total compensation as the base as opposed to just salaries. Just so we get a sense of the relative total compensation among all those positions.
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, that's a bit more difficult. We collect direct data on salaries. We don't collect direct data by type of position on benefits.
No, that's right.
We collect the benefits information in the aggregate. Now, clearly, we could take a shot at estimating that, but it's not a direct measure the way the salaries are.
Follow up?
Yeah, I would appreciate an estimate. And just to be clear, are the averages simple arithmetic means, or are they medians?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, they are means.
They're means.
We have individual person data here, so the mean is a true mean.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Still going back to this 2.8% increase for teachers in the last 16 years. Will some of that be explained by the supplemental retirement income that was negotiated? I know in a number of districts, school districts within my district, had negotiated that in lieu of direct salary increases. Would that be a partial explanation or even fairly significant?
Senator Morris, it's true that those supplemental payments aren't represented in these salary numbers. I would have to look at those. I don't believe the magnitude of those supplemental payments is relatively small. Those programs were put in place primarily to encourage earlier retirements at a time when districts felt it was financially advantageous to them to have higher paid teachers retire, higher experienced teachers on the upper end of the salary scale retire and be replaced by younger teachers on the lower end of the salary scale. But I certainly can take a look at the size of those payments. But my gut reaction is that they're not large enough to make a terribly big difference in the numbers we see here.
And I don't want to burden you, Mr. Reeder.
I think we're beyond that.
I think
Senator Morris.
Well, I don't want to go over the top, but I think your response is adequate. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
I don't want to burden Mr. Reeder also, but I thought if he has it, not that I want it generated, but if he has it, can you give us the average for the same period starting salary for a teacher, what the increase has been? Do you have that?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, I have actual data, salary data, for every teacher in Oregon, so I can isolate those teachers who are first-year teachers. Some will have bachelor's degrees, some will have master's degrees, so they will be at different education steps on the salary schedule, but I certainly can provide that. One thing that we find in Oregon, however, is that we have very few teachers, first-year teachers, who have only a bachelor's degree. It's almost universal now that teachers get a master's degree before they even start teaching, but I certainly can provide that information.
To make your job easier, Mr. Chairman, would it be, could we just compare, since that's what most teachers are doing now, could we just compare the starting for a teacher with a master's degree? Can we compare that? So I think that would give us the data that I think that I would be interested in. I'm just trying to see if the average starting has at least increased as much as the average teacher's salary.
And also, even with just Representative Edwards, I was thinking about your question, you're looking at the benefit package as well. It's hard to compare, even because then you get back to, well, in certain jobs in the private sector, you might have stock options. So it's difficult to compare, I think.
Chair Galizio, it is, although I haven't heard that any of our teachers have stock options.
School of the future, I don't know. Yeah,
what we do observe, however, is that different school districts around the state have fairly dramatically different salary schedules. The range of salaries, both average salaries and starting salaries, and each step of the salary schedule does vary considerably around the state. Okay, and finally, and this I'm hoping will answer Senator Starr's question about what our enrollment growth has looked like. Over the last 15 years, total enrollment in Oregon has gone up just over 15%, and that's just under 1% a year. But two groups in particular have grown dramatically faster. The first is special education students, up almost 52% over the period, and that's an annual average rate of about 2.8%. And then ELL students, English language learners, up well over 400% in the last 15 years, which is close to 16% a year, and that's just astounding growth.
Representative Jensen.
I don't want you to, you know, look at figures or look this up or anything, but when I look at special ed growth at 51.8%, to me, the obvious question comes up, why that dramatic a growth in this 15-year period of time? And do we have any sense that this is primarily caused by better identification of special ed students, therefore placement of them in that category? Or do we have indications that there's actually been some kind of a change in our population here?
Chair Galizio, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that question. I think in general, our special ed folks would tell you that we've become better at identifying certain learning disabilities. In particular, one of the fastest growing disabilities that we see is autism. And even though it's a relatively small share of all special ed students, it's growing very rapidly.
Percentage of autistic in the country is significant enough to be scary, especially if there's any, as it appears, there may be increasing numbers of autistic children. And I'm trying to get an idea there, and your answer was fine. I don't appreciate any more. I don't need any more.
Thank you.
So what does all this mean for the essential budget level? In other words, how do those cost drivers translate into how much funding we need to serve those students? And again, the essential budget level really takes a two budget period look. It says, here's how much we are spending this biennium, how much do we need to spend next biennium to provide that same level of services to our students in Oregon. And so here's sort of a high-level view of how we arrive at the essential budget level, keeping in mind that we put these together to line up with the governor's recommended budget, so they may be a little bit different than the revised numbers that we're looking at today, but the message is the same. We start out by estimating the total amount of both state and local resources required to serve all the students that we have after we take into account cost increases and enrollment growth. And the initial estimate of that was $7.89 billion. I'm sorry. That's the starting point from the prior biennium. Then we add to that inflation and enrollment growth, $0.72 billion or $720 million. From that, we subtract the level of local revenue that we expect, $2.8 billion, to arrive at the level of the state school fund that is required to meet the EBL. And when we put this together, that was the $5.81 billion, which I think in Darren's sheet equates to the 5806. It's just rounding. The only difference there is the rounding. So that's sort of the process that the School Revenue Forecast Committee goes through. Now, obviously, they devote a lot of time to understanding just how much this inflation piece is. We look at trends in salaries very closely. We also look at trends in enrollment growth by demographic group very closely to arrive at these numbers. So the EBL is one method of looking at funding requirements, and it's sort of grounded in where we are, what our actual experience is. It says, what are we doing now, and what does it take to continue doing that? A different approach in looking at funding requirements is the quality education model. And it takes a much different perspective. Instead of saying, what does it cost to continue doing what we're doing today, it asks the question, what would it cost to implement a system that would allow Oregon to meet its education goals as defined in statute? In other words, what would a highly effective, highly efficient system cost, and one that would get 90% of Oregon students to meet statewide standards? Now, that 90% is not in statute. That is that is the Quality Education Commission's interpretation of a reasonable goal to try to achieve. But it's sort of the other end of the spectrum from the EBL. Instead of saying what's it cost to continue what we're already doing, it asks what would it cost to improve the system to the point where we could dramatically increase student performance. The charge of the commission is to identify current practices and the cost of continuing those practices, in other words, something virtually identical to the EBL, also to identify best practices and the cost of implementing those, and then also to determine the expected student performance under those two different scenarios. So one thing that the commission has done is, since the initial part of its charge, the part of its charge that I mentioned earlier, current practices, really is an EBL kind of concept. What the commission has done is to embrace the EBL as their starting point. In other words, so that we're all talking about the same numbers and the same concept, the notion of current practices and EBL really are the same thing, and so the commission has embraced EBL as what the commission calls the baseline or our current situation. So again, the $5.81 billion of the EBL represents the quality education model's baseline scenario. And then the model's estimate of implementing best practices is $7.77 billion for the 2007-09 biennium. The difference between the two is the $1.96 billion that you may have heard. That sort of what's often referred to as the funding gap between the EBL and the quality education model. So really, two different views of funding levels. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about student performance and what the expectations of that would be under different funding levels. And for those of you who have glanced at the most recent report of the Quality Education Commission, these graphs may look familiar. The solid line on the bottom represents a forecast of expected numbers of students meeting or exceeding Oregon standards if current funding levels continue. In other words, if we just do EBL biennium after biennium, we expect student performance to continue to improve, because we've observed that over the last close to 15 years, that even though inflation-adjusted funding in Oregon has been relatively flat, we have seen some fairly dramatic improvements in student performance in the state, with percent meeting or exceeding standards increasing, particularly in the lower grades, by 20 to 30 percentage points. So fairly dramatic increases in the shares of students meeting standards. But as this graph, this is third grade math, shows, that we're close to 90% of students meeting standard today. And so there's not a lot of room for dramatic improvements beyond that. We have an upper limit of 100%, and as we get closer to that point, it becomes harder and harder to make progress. The dotted line in the graph shows our estimates of what that line would look like with the additional funding that the Quality Education Commission is recommending. In other words, the additional $1.96 billion would eventually get us a couple of percentage points more
in the third grade students meeting or exceeding standards.
Senator Morse, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rader, if we were to fund at the QAM level the $7.77 billion state school fund, where would that put us if we benchmarked against the other states in funding?
Chair Galizio, Senator Morse, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I certainly could make an estimate of that. As you know, Oregon historically, on a per-student basis, funded at above the national average until about 3 years ago, when we fell below the national average, and we continue to lose ground against the national average, or we did up to 2004-05 school year. But I don't know off the top of my head exactly where QEM funding would put us. But I certainly can get that information.
And Mr. Chair, if it's relatively easy to just look at some data and give it approximate, that would be fine. If it's difficult, don't do it. Thank you. But it does beg the question, Mr. Chair, colleagues, as to whether the QAM is anachronistic or is it, in fact, a model to try to achieve.
Fifth grade math, a similar graph. Our fifth graders currently are roughly 86%, I believe, meeting or exceeding standard. And again, we expect that to continue, but at a diminishing rate. And additional funding would bump that line up a bit. And again, really for the same reasons, the impacts here are not dramatic, primarily because we're already at quite a high level in terms of the share meeting or exceeding standards. But as we get into the 8th grade and the 10th grade, things are dramatically different. As you can see, we currently have roughly 65% of our 8th graders meeting or exceeding standards in math, and that that line of expected increases is fairly flat. With the additional funding at QEM levels, we would expect that line, the slope of that line, to increase fairly dramatically. These lines that come from the quality education model are based on some analysis that we did as part of the latest round of the Quality Education Commission. They are based on what we call an education production function, and they're statistical methods for relating funding and other characteristics of our education system, as well as characteristics of our schools and our students, to student performance. The goal here is to isolate the impact of funding independent of those other factors such as socioeconomic status and so forth. And what came out of that work is that the impact in the 8th grade is dramatically higher than the 3rd and 5th grade.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Devlin had a question.
Yeah.
Mr. Reeder, one thing that we sometimes hear when we're reviewing these in a committee, and I just wanted you to reflect upon this and so I can see what your understanding is. Some people have maintained that for third and fifth grade, we set the levels at relatively moderate levels to meet the standard. And that at the 10th grade in particular, that we set it at a much higher level. Now, the casual observer to this would say somehow
your students are simply just declining in abilities when they leave elementary mm-hmm. school. But is it that they are declining in abilities, or that we just put the expectations so much higher? So if we made the expectations higher at the lower grades, would we see similar numbers to what we see at the 10th grade?
Well, Chair DeLizio, Senator Gavelin, you're exactly right. There are two things going on here. The first is what we call cut scores, or what assessment folks call cut scores, and that is what is the score at which you are considered to have met standard. And the question is, are those at appropriate levels, and are they aligned across grades? In other words, are those scores, those cut scores at which we say the student has met standard, do those reflect consistent expectations as students move through the grades, or have we set them too low in the early grades and or too high in the later grades? And that's a very difficult question to ask, or to answer. It's even hard to ask. The department right now is going through the process of reevaluating those scores at which the cut scores at which students are considered to have met standard, with particular attention to the very question you asked. That is, are they at the right levels as you progress through the grades? The other half of that story is, well, maybe our students just stop performing. You know, our expectations aren't too high, they simply aren't meeting them very well. And I don't think we have an answer to that question yet until we take a closer look at whether those cut scores are set at a consistent level or not.
Thank you. When the chair thinks back to eighth grade and what he was like, this makes perfect sense. Representative Jensen.
Chair Shannon, I don't think we're going to follow on that. The phenomenon that you're bringing up here, that Senator Devlin, the question that he's raising, and I appreciate your answer to that, and I appreciate that the department has been looking at, this. But one of the things I'm wondering if we're taking into consideration when we are making this evaluation to try to understand why the upper grades seem not able to get close to meeting the expectations or the standards that we want, is the change in methodology of instruction when we go from the fifth grade to the middle schools and then to the high schools. And I'm wondering, and if I were a younger person, I probably would be fascinated by looking at trying to study this. I'm wondering if this is not an indictment of the phenomenon of the middle schools. There's really quite a transition in the way that students are treated, as I observed it, between those elementary lower grades and the middle school grades. And the question of whether the old way was, in fact, maybe superior to what our new mode of operation might be. Rhetorical, I guess, question, and not one I expected. But I would be interested in whether or not the department, as they look at this, if this is an item of consideration, that they've thought about this as they proceed through.
Representative Jensen, yes. I mean, the department has thought about this, particularly in the context of high school. There are a number of things going on here. One thing that we have talked about at length is the fact that the 10th grade assessment often has content areas that students haven't been taught yet. That, you know, they may have concepts that are learned in, for example, Algebra 2, and a number of those students won't get to Algebra 2 until they're in 11th grade. And so this idea that we're testing students before we teach them is a factor that we're looking at very closely. But in a more general sense, the notion that the way we approach high school may not be the best way to do it. And that's what the high school restructuring debate is all about, is are there better ways to do high school? And that probably would spill over into the middle schools as well to a certain extent. But I'm not an expert on any of those things, so I should probably keep my mouth shut.
Whether any of us are experts on those things all depend on how far we are from home.
Okay. And finally, 10th grade. And again, what we observe here is that on average, only about half of our 10th graders are meeting our math standards. And I present only math here because the reading graphs are virtually identical. And the line under current conditions is almost entirely flat. The line under higher funding, as recommended by the Quality Education Commission, is higher, but not quite as steep as the 8th grade graph. And that comes directly out of the modeling that we've done at the department with the production functions, where we look at the actual experience of Oregon schools to see how they vary as funding varies. So these are empirically based forecasts here, and what we found was that the impact in the 8th grade was larger than it was in the 10th grade. The conclusion, and this, you'll find this in the Quality Education Commission's report, is that the slopes of these lines are shallow enough that the conclusion is that it's not funding alone that we need to pay attention to. And that's why there's so much urgency behind the high school reform discussions, is that even with additional resources, we're not going to get where we want to be in high school. There's some fundamental reforms that need to be made if we're going to get close to 90% of our students to meet standards. We're under NCLB closer to 99%.
Hi, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Reeder, fundamental reforms. The governor's only allocated $10 million to the increased requirements that the state board has been discussing. So what do you mean? Could you define what you mean by fundamental reforms and what the cost is for that?
Chair Benizio, Senator Walker, I use that term in a fairly general way simply to indicate that many Oregon high schools, or as measured by the share of their students meeting standard, are not performing at levels that we would like to see. In terms of specific reforms, I'm not the right person to talk about what those would look like, or what those would involve, or what they would cost. Simply observing, though, that we have seen over the past 15 years a very dramatic increase in performance in third and fifth grade, less dramatic in eighth grade, and very little improvement in the 10th grade.
Again, that begs the question, Mr. Chair. If they're failing 10th grade math, and we're going to change the requirements and add more math, where's the failure coming from? That's what I want to know. At what point are they failing? Is it that transition from middle school to high school because they're not prepared for high school math? Or are kids just tuning out on math? I don't know where it is, but I know I'm very concerned about the new math requirements, and mean, $10 million, Mr. Chair, we had testimony when we were, our committee was in Reedsport, the, from the Coos Bay School District. They said that their share of $10 million is half a teacher. Half a teacher. I don't know where we're going from here, but it's a policy question we haven't yet answered.
Thank you, Senator. Can I just a quick question? And I'm not looking for any, I don't want more paper, but just off the top of your head, do you you must look at other states or comparator states. I mean, how unique is Oregon when you look at 3rd, 5th versus 10th? It's kind of a non-unique.
Chair Valenzio, Oregon is not unique. I think just about every state in the country is experiencing the same phenomenon.
That's okay, but I was just curious.
Mr. Chair, the real comparison that'll be is how do kids in the United States compare to kids in China and India and Bangladesh and Europe, and you know, as we look at our kids lining up in the world economy, I think those are where we ought to really be concerned, and not just be concerned obviously about Oregon kids, but the kids across the nation if Oregon's kids are doing as poorly as kids in other states.
Well, Barnhart, and I agree with that completely, and I would simply add to it that it's much beyond our education system, I think. I think it's a societal issue. I think it has to do with the way we treat our children, the way we think about them, the exposure we give them to the work world, or the lack of exposure we give them to the work world, the collapse of the family, and a whole variety of other things that are going on in the United States. And I would love to have a silver bullet. I don't believe there is one.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
For one time in this committee, you would note that I am in total agreement with the representative from Eugene on my left.
Thank you, Representative. On your left.
I don't disagree with this side or the other when I share concern.
Absolutely. Loud and clear.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the database initiative project. As you know, 7 or 8 years ago, the department embarked on a very ambitious system of revamping our data collection and storage and presentation capabilities. We moved to a web-based data collection. We moved to a consistent, what we call, chart of accounts across all school districts, so that the definitions, particularly in the financial data, were consistent across all districts, so that the data that we collect would be comparable. And simply want to point out that system has paid what I consider rather large dividends in terms of giving us higher quality data that really allows us to truly compare districts to other districts in Oregon, something that prior to that was not really possible given the variations in the way different districts defined different things. The work both of the School Revenue Forecast Committee and the Quality Education Commission rely very heavily on that data collected by the Department of Education, and really would not be possible without that comprehensive data collection system that the department put in place. We don't hear much, or you may not hear much today about the Database Initiative Project, and I've even heard been asked by a number of people, why did you kill that project? And the answer is, well, we didn't. It's alive and well, and it continues to improve, but it sort of does its job behind the scenes, and we continue to improve our data collection activities and improve the quality of the data.
Reports of the depth of the DBI are having exaggerated. Well, Mr. Reeder, would it be okay, number one, to protect you from any more homework? And since the funding formula is the next bit on the slide, and that's closer to 10th grade than 3rd grade, do you think this would be a okay with you, a logical stopping point for today?
For Louisville, absolutely.
Okay.
Without hesitation, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, if there are no other, I'm going to close the public hearing on 5020 and 5021, and we are adjourned.